Welcome to this week's edition of Flashback Friday, your opportunity to get some good review by listening to episodes from the past that Jason has handpicked to help you today in the present and propel you into the future. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, listeners. It's an amazing time to be alive. And this is your host, Jason Hartman. It is most definitely an amazing time to be alive. With all of the problems in the world, there's a lot of incredible stuff going on out there at the very same time. One of them is the millennial generation that we've talked about so much, Generation Y, and we're going to be talking soon about Generation Z, because they will be coming into the housing market. They're up next. They're at bat, just right around the corner here. They're on the, what do they call it, the practice mound? No, I don't know. My little league days were a long time ago, folks, and I really don't keep up with spectator sports. So anyway, whatever, you know, they're in the, not the dugout, but they're right there, you know, warming up, whatever. Okay, Jason, let's just not show your ignorance here, and let's get on with what you do know about, and that is the millennial generation. I looked at an article a couple of days ago, and it talked about the millennials are here. Well, no, not the millennials, actually. The millennials' children are here. And they need babysitters. Yes, this is a Business Insider article, and it just says, folks, millennials are growing up, and as millennials grow up, they begin to do things their parents did. For example, have kids. In 2014, the U.S. birth rate increased for the first time since 2007. Now remember, that is not the population rate. It's the birth rate. Okay? So that's different. There's been a massive amount of immigration since then. So these are two different things. So don't panic if you're saying, well, Jason, I thought the population was increasing faster, and that's why we needed to provide more rental housing, and housing demand was going up, and that was behind the massive increases we've seen in prices and rents. I actually had dinner with one of our clients last night. He was talking about a couple of his Phoenix properties and how one doubled in value since the low, and one almost tripled. Can you believe that? Yes, it's an amazing time to be a real estate investor, the most historically proven asset class in world history. So, back to the article. So, the millennials recently became the largest generation in the U.S., overtaking the baby boomers, and I've told you about that many times before. Remember, baby boomers, that demographic, what they call it, a demographic cohort, it's about 76 million people. Of course, there is some difference of opinion on this, depending on who you talk to. They cut these birth rates off at different years, and the demographers don't completely agree on this stuff. No big deal, though. It's close enough for government work, as they say. 76 million baby boomers. That was the largest ever, but the millennials are 80 million, slightly larger than the baby boomers by about 4 million people, and they are now starting to have kids. Now, granted, they didn't do it as quickly as the baby boomers did. Gen X, my generation, is sort of, I don't know what to make of Gen X. It's like this really small demographic cohort, only about 46 million people. And you might ask, well, who is ahead of the baby boomers? You know, those more elderly, more senior folks ahead of the baby boomers. What are they called? Well, they are called the maturers. I know that's kind of hard to say, but that's what demographers call them. And those are the people that some call the greatest generation. And they basically, they did a lot of the hard work, so we didn't have to. They made a lot of the sacrifices. That's my grandparents' generation. May they rest in peace. They're not all resting in peace. Many of them are still alive, not mine. So we look at these different demographic cohorts, and the millennial generation now starting to have kids, of course, not doing it as quickly or as early as prior generations. They are, like I said, delaying family formation and waiting to marry, waiting to have kids. So that keeps them in the rental market longer, doesn't it? Because they usually don't feel a bunch of pressure to go and buy that house with the white picket fence, that sort of stereotypical house that very few people actually live in, but it's talked about. It's called the American dream. Well, I think the American dream should really be being a great real estate investor rather than being a homeowner, because a home is a liability. It is not an asset. But owning income-producing real estate, that's an asset. So get lots of that. You can rent your house, have more flexibility there, but whatever you want to do. The point is, this article is really about the labor market, and it says that the millennial generation needs babysitters. And so you see this cohort coming into its own now, and an anemic job market, massive student loan debt. Some of them are starting to have some kids. You know, it's about time. I think people have said that to me before, too. It is about time. I say it to myself. Got to find the right bride first. So, I don't know. You know, your host gets a little punchy here on Sunday afternoon. So this is talking about how non-farm payrolls grew by 287,000, the most since October of 2015, and 107,000 more than expected. But be careful before you read too much into that, because that's all manipulated like crazy. We've talked many times about discouraged workers, about how they don't count those people in the unemployment rate. And the more important metric, which is known as the labor participation rate, that is far more accurate than what you will hear quoted when we look at employment numbers and we hear about them in the news and read about them in the mainstream media, or otherwise known as the lamestream media. So some different things here, but always look at the labor participation rate. It's a much better metric, in my opinion. And listen to the episode I did with John Williams of Shadow Stats. And by the way, I thought we were going to talk about buy-downs today, but we're not, because I think I really covered that on episode number 693. Oh, sorry, I don't even think I mentioned the episode number. Episode number 698 today, 698. So if you go back 5 episodes, if you happen to miss that one and you want to know about buy-downs, which are a fantastic tool for financing your investment properties, listen to episode number 693. The guest on that episode is John R. Lott, but the intro portion, I go in detail about buying down your mortgage and analyzing whether or not that's worth it and doing the math there. So check out episode 693 for that. But today, our guest will be Shane Sauer. He's with Rent Facts, talking about finding stable rental neighborhoods. And I want to give you a word of caution as you listen to this episode, because here's the thing. This is a great tool, but it's like any tool. It's not perfect, and it's not the holy grail. It would be like saying, well, let's do a show about Zillow or Trulia or Realtor.com or any one of these websites out there that provides valuation information, market information, et cetera, et cetera. Look, folks, these are simply tools. They are not the holy grail. Take everything with a grain of salt, because a computer and an algorithm can only do so much when you're analyzing things. The most powerful analysis of all is still, and it won't always be, as AI, artificial intelligence, comes into its own. I may well change what I say about this in 5 or 10 years. Absolutely, when we're at episode number 3,291. I don't know what episode we'll be at then, but anyway, we'll have more episodes then. And AI will be incredibly powerful. As you all know, Watson, the IBM computer, won the game of Jeopardy, which is, you got to be pretty smart to win Jeopardy. Of course, it can beat any chess champion now. That's really no big deal anymore. And it's an amazing time to be alive. But still, this stuff does not tell you everything. And so here's the deal. Shane did a free analysis on two rental properties that I just purchased in Memphis. And, you know, by looking at the report, they didn't look so great, but he helped me drill down onto them in a little more detail. And he said, these are great properties. And I thought they were great properties too, because I did not see this report. And so you got to use some judgment with this stuff, folks. It's not the be all end all, but it is something. It's a tool. Use it as a tool. A tool is not everything. You know, it's like that old saying, and this is an important old saying. Stephen Covey used to talk about it, but he didn't create the saying. It came before him, and it is this. You ready? The map is not the territory. The map is not the territory. So the map is good. It's a tool, and maps are great. Hey, where would we be without cartography, without maps? Maps used to say that the world was flat, and they even drew dragons at the edge of the world because that's what they thought you would run into as Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. And the map is not the territory. The map tells you a lot, but it doesn't tell you everything. So I think the most powerful tool we have in our arsenal is aggregating data from our clients and aggregating data from our ground troops, the people actually in the markets on a daily basis. A lot of those are the property managers, but they're also the local market specialists. These are very, very powerful tools. But we want to use additional tools like the one we're going to talk about today as a helpful tool. But just remember, the map is not the territory. That's a great thing to remember in so many parts of life, isn't it? Very, very powerful concept. Okay, so let's get to it. Let's get to our guest. Check out Hartman Education for some great educational resources that a lot of you have taken advantage of. That's our newest website with some great tools, great educational products there for you. And we've got an event coming up, and on the next episode, we're going to talk about that in detail. Early September in Phoenix, Arizona. Yeah, right here. You're going to want to come to that because this is a totally new event where we're going to use software, another tool to help us manage our real estate portfolio, to help us evaluate properties and whether or not we should buy them. We're going to combine that with some very practical, pragmatic, kind of quick start oriented stuff for investors. And that will be in Phoenix. That's going to be a 2-day event, not a property tour, but an educational event in early September. And of course, that will be posted very soon at jasonhartman.com. We don't even have a name for this event yet. We wanted to do a different type of event. Last year, as you may recall, we launched JHU, Jason Hartman University, where we really go into deal analysis. We go into using math to analyze properties, where we have attendees, students do the math themselves by hand, you know, with just a regular old calculator, not special software. And that's been a fantastic, very powerful course. A lot of you have attended that, and a lot of you have given us some great feedback and great testimonials about that. But we're going to add one more type of event, and this is going to be it in September. So you won't want to miss it. Look out for more information on that, but mark your calendars for the second weekend of September. And before that, we're going to have a Venture Alliance trip the first weekend of September, which is actually Labor Day weekend, a long weekend. So if you've been interested in Venture Alliance, check out VentureAllianceMastermind.com for more info there. Talk to your investment counselors about that, and we'll be glad to fill you in. Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday. All right, let's get to our guest and talk about finding good, stable rental neighborhoods. It's my pleasure to welcome Shane Sauer to the show. He is one of the co-founders of a company that is doing some innovative stuff, or actually has been doing some innovative stuff in the residential rental space for the last decade called RentFacts. And we're going to find out more about how to pick a good area in which to invest for long-term buy and hold rentals. Shane, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself, Jason?
Good. It's good to have you on the show. Where are you located?
We are located out of Kansas City.
Fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit about RentFacts. I mean, what does it do? We've all heard of Carfax with all of their advertising, and you know that'll give you some reports on the car you're buying. And I guess RentFacts does the same thing in the real estate market, right?
You know, the best example or metaphor I could probably give is like a credit score for you, a borrower. Let's say a good old FICO score that. The credit score is going to tell a lender or whatever the likelihood that you're going to repay a debt. So a lot of what RentFacts is doing is it's giving scores to rental properties in their ability to generate income. So RentFacts generates a score from 0 to 100, and from that score, it's a quick glance at way investor or lender can look and see the income stability from a rental property.
Okay, fantastic. So the stability and what areas of information does it provide? Let's just dive down into all the different types of reports. I guess, first of all, that's a good question. How many reports do you offer?
So there's really about four different reports, and there's the first report is what we call the risk report, and that is an acronym for rental income stability. And so that's the first report. Then we have the rent report, which, much as it sounds, provides a detailed estimate of the anticipated rent for the property. Then we have a vacancy report. And then we can roll all those reports up into packages as well. And we have an income package that kind of gives all that information in one single kind of pulls all those reports together.
Okay, great. So let's drill down on that a little bit. Say, for example, a rental price report where you want to know the projected rent you might get on the property. Some investors out there are using different tools for this, like rent range and so forth. And, you know, they're only somewhat accurate. They're certainly not, they're not everything, right? How do you come up with rental prices when every house is so individual?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is definitely a very difficult thing to accomplish from a technology perspective, because just as you know and I know that the season you're trying to rent in versus the condition of the property at the time of rental, all those factors can play into ultimately what a property will rent for. But what we've done is we've put our best foot forward of trying to really nail down and tailor that rent to the subject property. And we've done it in a way that's very transparent to the user. So, Jason, I don't know if you've ever seen an appraisal report, but they use what's called
only a million times.
Okay. So, when you're going through that, they have what they call a sales comparable grid. And that's where the appraiser's picking similar properties and making adjustments up and down as compared to the subject property. We've used that exact same approach for rental properties. And so not only can the user of the report see what comps we've selected, but then they can see what we felt was inferior or superior and how we adjusted the subject property up and down.
Okay, so I'm glad you said that, and let me just, maybe you were going to cover this, but let me just chime in for a moment. So the difference is, though, that many times that local appraiser has actually seen some of those other comps when they're valuing the house. Sometimes they haven't. They're certainly reading, hopefully, reading the remarks in the MLS and or driving by the property. Now, again, none of this will tell you everything, but they are additional clues in that valuation, right? How does software do that, though? See, this isn't a person doing it like the appraiser. And of course, it would be too expensive and onerous for a simple rental report to go out and have an appraiser do all that. Of course, I understand that, and so do our listeners. But how good is software getting at making adjustments for these types of things?
Well, it's getting better and better. Let me give you two examples of that. So we've spent, as you suggested when we started earlier, that we've spent about a decade working on this information. And one thing that we have done is that we know that comps that reside in the same neighborhood as the subject property have a higher likelihood of sharing similar attributes, age, configurations, and everything else. And so one area that we've excelled in where others haven't is we don't necessarily drive how good a comp is by how close it is to the subject, but we drive comps on how similar the neighborhoods are to each other. And that's really a unique approach in the marketplace. So, you know, a great example is there are certain towns that you can go two blocks in one direction and the dynamics of the neighborhood change completely.
You know, that has always amazed me, not as a real estate person, but just as a person in general, how micro these neighborhoods are. It really is amazing how hyper-localized the world of real estate is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so what we've decided to do is just because you've only gone two blocks, if that neighborhood, the demographics and data behind that neighborhood are significantly different than where the subject property is located, we can see that through data, and we de-emphasize that comp. And so when we make adjustments, we're not counting on that comp as hard. So that's a way that, you know, we've been able to use data and technology to produce, you know, a better estimated rent. And then as far as, you know, looking at a curb appeal and everything else, you know, thanks to Google these days, you know, our reports and our website, you know, we use a lot of Google's tools. And so, you know, you can drop and just look at these other comps on the map and drop your guy in there and get a good street view and just see from a curb appeal of does the house look similar? Is it a two-story versus ranch or this, that, and the other? So there are some ways that we're trying to use technology to help people make better decisions. But as you said before, you know, setting a rent is really, you can get pretty darn close to technology, but in the end, it's probably just takes a real estate professional to ultimately just nail that down.
Yeah, again, people need to realize these are all tools. They're not the end all and be all. They're just a tool. They're a clue. And it drives some real estate people nuts that Zillow even exists, right? But, you know, we didn't have anything before in that space. And so now we have something, and you've just got to understand it's not the gospel. Take everything with a grain of salt. The technology is not perfect, and neither are the human beings for that matter. So it's all just a clue. But okay, so this is just an incredibly complex algorithm that must be able to do all those things, right?
Yeah, it took a lot of help and a lot of time to, you know, put the product together and put it out there. But you really hit the nail on the head with what you just said, that, you know, we have the humility, you know, as founders of RentFacts to really just tell people that we've provided a great tool and it should be used appropriately. And so we never discount local knowledge and local real estate professionals, but a lot of what occurs in today's world is very fast-paced. There's a lot of opportunity coming at us. And so if you have tools that you can open up your funnel, if you will, and digest more and get to better decisions quicker, then those are valuable tools. And I think that's a lot of what RentFacts set out to do, is to help people make better decisions quicker. Not necessarily the final decision or the end decision, but let's make good decisions quickly.
Right. Okay. I don't want to belabor that point, but just I want the listeners to hear, how does it compare similar neighborhoods? Say, for example, you're in Memphis or Atlanta or any of the markets in which we like to invest, Indianapolis, for example, you know, there's Cincinnati. You're in that market, and it doesn't take the closest comp for rent. It takes the more similar neighborhood, you said, right?
Correct.
How does it do that? How do you know what neighborhoods are similar? I mean, you can't get that from Google Street View. I suppose you could get it, I mean, because that's just too much of an impression a human would have to make, although AI is, you know, it's upon us, right?
Yeah.
But do you do it by taking, okay, here's the median income in that neighborhood. What is it? Is it by zip code? It can't be. A zip code's too big.
It is too big.
So, you know, is Zip Plus 4? Do you take the school scores, the crime? Do you aggregate all of that data? Tell us a little bit about that.
You got it. I should have just, you know, turned the mic over to you. But, you know, again,
I'm just guessing. You're the expert.
Well, here's what we did. Is the first thing is we realized is that we know a lot about real estate, but by no means are we experts in the what's called geospatial data segment. And so we went out and partnered with the nation's leading company in geospatial data. And these are folks, PhDs, and a lot of them that just study data associated with the geographic location. So what we did over the course of, you know, the last 10 years in constant development is we now know the data points that most heavily influence the stability of rental income. So we now, through our partnership with this company, are harvesting and aggregating all that data, and then we're refining it through our algorithms to simplify it down to a number. So just as you said, schools, crime, income, I mean, the list goes on and on, all the way down from vacancies, appreciation rates. In total, we are using just a little bit over 100 different data points that get filtered down into what we would say 15 key components that then ultimately end up in one score. So a lot of data crunching, but done through partnership with that company and then our background and all our contacts in the real estate field.
So let me ask you a question. There's this thing in the world of real estate investment, and I'll just call it, for maybe lack of a better term, the $30,000 house phenomenon. Maybe you're familiar with what I'm about to say. And we never got into that market, my real estate investment company. We always liked the class C plus B, A properties especially, because on paper, those C and D type properties, they look great. But you just can't collect the damn rent often enough, you know? And I mean, look, if you're going to be a very active manager, if you got, you know, a gun and a holster on your hip, I'm somewhat joking about this, I'm being a little sarcastic for entertainment value, but not completely. As my ex-girlfriend used to say, there's a little bit of truth in every joke, right? if you're really an engaged active manager, and that makes you, and that's a specialty of yours, these lower end properties, I've seen many people do very well with it. Okay. So I'm not saying it's a no-no. I'm just saying for most investors that want to have a more passive type of investment, and nothing's completely passive, that the B and the A and the B type properties just work better in real life. And you mentioned that word, rental stability. So I wanted to see what your impression is of that. And, you know, maybe that, not just talking about your software, but maybe it leads to some advice for our investor listeners.
Yeah, well, number one, I feel like we should hire you on as a spokesperson for our company, because, again, you're really making this easy for me. So let me maybe just take you back to the very first day when the concept of RentFacts was born. So myself, I've been an investor and currently a lender in this segment for, you know, a long time. I'll just say that. And then the other co-founder has been a property manager for edging up on 30 years. And let me tell you why we wanted to create this. What really drove this is that we got tired of seeing good people, investors, making bad decisions because they didn't know any better. And when I say bad decisions, I'm referring to that C-class property that looked awesome on paper, and they bought it and they sunk their life savings into it, and it ended up being a disaster. And it was so sad and sickening in a way that it motivated us to say, look, this doesn't have to happen anymore. There's enough data, there's enough information out there. We can prevent this and create a tool to help people make these better decisions. And that's how RentFacts was started. So where it's gotten today is from this single score this risk score, we can take, if I had 5 minutes with an investor and said, tell me about your investment lifestyle, as sometimes I refer to that way, Do you work a full-time job? You don't want to be hassled with tenant calls. You know, it's truly as passive as possible. Or are you really looking for the deal? You're willing to own or manage yourself. You don't mind beating, you know, knocking on the door yourself for rents, this and that. Getting an idea of the investment lifestyle, then from that, we can identify a risk score range that is appropriate for that.
It's funny that you mentioned that, Shane, because one of the things that we find ourselves doing over and over at my company is matching the investor's personality, interestingly. And maybe this is a whole nother business, the like psychology of investing angle, you know, matchmaking. And we call ourselves investment matchmakers and investment therapists to some extent, because we match them with the type of property that, you know, we kind of just can sense their personality, what they're willing to tolerate and what they're not. You know, when you've got that real sort of do-it-yourselfer investor that's kind of involved and doesn't mind rolling up their sleeves, and I don't mean doing actual work, but I mean just sort of engaging in the process, then, you know, they can do that type of property more. But if they want just to, you know, kick back and get the mailbox money and maybe occasionally deal with an issue here or there, it's a different type of property in a different market, isn't it?
It is. It is completely. And that's the what you're doing for your clients and your audience is really a gift, because real estate investing is, there's just so much more to it than I think most people understand. And to have a good experience with it, and I'm not talking about making money. Of course, we all want to make money. It's an investment, and that's what it's out to do. But there's making money and just having it being painful to go along with it. And so what you're doing is great, because you're aligning both. Here's how not only you're going to make money, but how you can enjoy what you're doing as well.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday. Well, you know, I came up with a new little phrase I coined. Maybe someone else said it too, but I never heard it before. I swear it's original. And I did a deal a few months ago, and I thought, you know, that deal, I did make some money, but man, that took, I was engaged in that. It was a pain. And I, you know, instead of saying ROI, return on investment, my new thing is return on involvement. Like, how much do I need to be involved to make this money, right? To make that return. And if the return on involvement is too high, then I got to look at the opportunity cost. If I spent that time in my business, would I make more? And a lot of times the answer is painfully yes. You know, the investment wasn't necessarily the best return on involvement. So I encourage investors to think about ROI also as return on involvement.
Yep. Well, you and I think the same. The term we use here is we call it effort to earn. How much effort
to earn. Yeah.
Yep. How much effort do I need to put in to earn that money?
And the E to E ratio.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the exact same thing you're talking about of return on involvement or effort to earn. You know, you and I are thinking exactly the same.
So did we make that point? Because I want to make sure we get to more of what people should analyze when looking for a property. I don't know if we're ready to leave that, though. Are we? Or do you want to say more about it?
Well, I think we kind of, you know, a good way to sum it up is you know, you need to have good alignment of how your willingness to engage or your involvement or your effort that's going to go into the investment as it relates to the location of the rental property. It's that simple.
I think that is very, very good advice. Okay, so we started off talking about rental comps and then went into rental stability. And so is your thesis that the more you get more rental stability in the A and B type neighborhoods? I think we agree on that,
yes.
Right? I just want to make sure.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Okay. So beyond that, let's talk about like vacancy rates. How do you calculate or project that?
Yeah. So we've really challenged the industry on what's called a vacancy rate. And I'm going to try to be as concise as possible, but what we've studied and spent a lot of time looking at is tenancy duration, meaning how long are tenants in the neighborhood staying there? Because what we've found through the years of working a lot of real results or from the pro forma is that tenancy duration is a huge driver of you obtaining what you think you're going to make on that rental property. So if you're suffering a vacancy at frequencies much more than you thought, it's what I call the pro forma killer. And so we focused, when we looked at vacancy, we put our focus on how long are tenants staying in there versus what the industry has kind of adopted as just how many vacant units are in that neighborhood as a percentage. And so we've deviated from that and just really studied neighborhoods that tenants move in, love it, stay there. And so you get a tenant, on some of our records, we're showing tenancies lasting over 7-8 years, which is just a dream come true if you're the owner of that property, because you have a nice steady revenue stream coming in to support that investment.
Okay, so I want to give a word of caution to our listeners, though. Feel free to argue with me on this if you want, Shane. But I tell you, if your vacancy rate is too low, your rent is too cheap. Okay, instead of saying, I want to have occupancy 100% of the time, an investor should say, in my opinion, that I want to target a vacancy rate of, say, 6%. So I want to have a 94% occupancy. Now, on our performas, we put 8% per year as the vacancy. That's what we put in our performas as a mandate. 1 month per year is that basic rule. Now, you might have a tenant stay 2 years, and then you might have 2 months of vacancy, but average 1 month per year. So I would just say that because I think the problem you could have, and this is where you need more than data, you need to think and tease out the data a little bit, where you could have problems like this is in these really nice higher-end neighborhoods where owners have a lot of equity because they've owned the houses for a long time, and that usually leads them to not be very pushy on the rents, and the rent-to-value ratios, of course, are way out of sync in higher-priced markets. And it reminds me of when I lived in Newport Beach, California. There are these neighborhoods in, say, an area like Corona Del Mar, this great little beach community, where these tenants stay a long time. But the reason they stay a long time is because they've got such a fantastic deal. You know, I wouldn't move either if I was renting a $1 million house for $2,600 a month, right? That's a great deal. So that's the one part where I would just caution people a little bit to not only look at the data. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And I put that in the bucket. I have a bucket I call good problems to have. So if as an investor, you're trying to gauge of how long I want to keep my tenant versus how much I'm going to raise their rent, that goes in the bucket of good problems. What we're really was concerning to us is the other side of the spectrum, and that's, you know, a C-class property or something where you work that pro forma anticipating you have an expectation of vacancy, but you're losing a tenant every 9 months. And not only on top of that, when they're moving out, there's damage, you gotta make repairs, you got to increase marketing appeal, you got to put the new tenant in, and you start the cycle over. And what we just saw is there were certain areas, despite, you know, the best screening possible and good management and everything else, just the collective pool of tenants that wanted to live in that neighborhood, you just couldn't have a high expectation of the overall performance from those tenants. So it wasn't management driven. It wasn't anything but demographic location driven. It was a neighborhood that was, you know, you just couldn't win in. And those were, that's really was kind of on the forefront of our brain when we looked at vacancy of how do we identify those areas where it's just the nature of the beast, if you will, where tenants are just moving in and out and in and out, and it's just very hurtful to the investment. So,
yeah, that really diminishes your performance, of course. You know, I would be curious, Shane, does your system parse out Section 8 government-assisted rentals and analyze? I would love to see data, although I bet you'd get accused of, oh, that's unfair, it's not politically correct, you're racist. You know, all this absolute stupidity you hear coming out of people sometimes nowadays. You know, I would love to look at data of Section 8 tenants versus non-Section 8 tenants, because interestingly, you know, and think of just human motivation, when you're on the dole, and you're getting something for free, or, you know, and the government's paying for part or all of your rent, those people are kind of stable to some extent. You know, they're not that bad. It's just a different business, you know. And I know people that love Section 8 and people that hate it. So there's very little middle ground, I find, on the Section 8 type tenants. You know, just kind of curious as to what your thoughts are on that.
Well, number one, our system, no, we don't distinguish that information or data. So that's on the system side. But personally speaking, you know, I have a pretty long history and awareness of Section 8 renters and managing and owning those properties. And so I would agree with you. It's a very polarized group of people. Of either people love them or people hate them. And I am the guy that falls in the middle. And at the end of the day, the Section 8's a program and it's a voucher, but I still found that it was the tenant. And there was Section 8 tenants that we just had a great relationship with and it worked well. And we had Section 8 tenants that it wasn't, and it did work good. And so I could see why it swings both ways. And for me, I would just always encourage an investor of, like, look, Section 8 isn't a one big bucket. There's families and people within that bucket. And so all your standard screening and everything you would do for an open market tenant, you need to do for a Section 8 tenant. So
everything is an individual basis. Exactly. There's no question about that. Every person is an individual, no question. But it would just be really interesting to see real data on marketplaces divided up that way. That'd be fascinating. It's not going to happen. So that's okay. Okay. So vacancy rates, what else do you want us to know about vacancy rates?
You know, I mean, and that's it. I mean, I probably could go on and on, but I think hopefully you and the audience kind of get an idea of what we went out to do. And that was spend more time looking at tenancy durations than anything else. And so, from that information, I think investors can, you know, really understand if that's going to be a problem and make adjustments on their pro forma accordingly before they buy the property.
How else can we use the tool? What else can it tell us?
Well, so we started with risk, and that's that rental income stability index we talked about. So that's the first and number one score I always advise people to pull. It kind of tells you the neighborhood you're working in. Then after that, we talked about rents, and that's a good, you know, top-line revenue number to work from. Then you can plug in your vacancy. Then after that, it gets pretty localized because we do in our pro forma package, we offer suggestions on property management costs, property taxes, and stuff like that. But, you know, at that point, I think if you've got a good data-driven information for the risk associated with the location, the potential revenue, how the vacancy looks, you're probably ready to put it into your own home-cooked spreadsheet or whatever you want, plug in what your property manager charges and everything else. And you're off and running to have a much more accurate and reliable pro forma to make any investment decisions off of.
Yeah, good information. Any just general advice you want to share with investors from your experience over all these years?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go back to something you said, and that is that there is no silver bullet in this industry. And so I would encourage investors to just aggregate as much information, talk to as many folks as you can. You can never know too much about the investments you're making. And if you don't have the time and resource to do that, then you need to understand that and seek professionals and be willing to pay for those services as well. And so I just see the biggest mistakes are when people move in, not in haste, but because they're uneducated. And so get educated up, or, you know, get schooled up, if you will, before you make those decisions.
Or get someone who is educated, who's your advocate, who's on your side.
Exactly.
The only thing I want to say about that is absolutely education is super important, but there is a flip side to it. There are the people who are the educated derelicts who just learn all their life and never do anything. And that's, you know, nothing happens until you actually do something.
Analysis paralysis.
Yeah, yeah. The the analysis paralysis problem is a significant one with some. How much do all these different reports and resources cost that you offer?
Yeah, so it's a lot of it depends on volume and the amount of data you want. So it can be as cheap as a couple bucks and goes up to, you know, some of our more complete packages are still under $20 for all that information. But, you know, it all varies on how much data you're looking for and how frequently you want to see the data. So, but I always tell people it's a couple bucks to maybe up to 20, but as compared to the investment you're making, it's really negligible.
And do you have it for literally every address in America? I mean, I can plug in a property in Detroit, God forbid, I bet the rental stability wouldn't be very good, or Atlanta, or California, right? I mean, anywhere?
That's right. All 50 states, everywhere. When we built the system, we did our very best to make sure that anything that got plugged in that we were going to, you know, try to be able to provide information on that location. As you can imagine, some spots get a lot harder than others, but it is a nationwide, all 50 states, any location, you'll be able to pull risk, rents, and vacancy.
Well, that's interesting you said that, because that's what I was going to ask you. Is the data just as good in every area? Is it the same? Or in some areas, can you rely on the data more than you can on others? I mean, I would assume some areas are just slim on data and you don't have a lot to pull from, right?
Yeah, again, it varies on what data. On the risk index, you know, we used pretty broad resources that dig pretty deep. And where there were quote-unquote holes, we found good ways to make good patches for that. So that we're pretty good there. But as you can imagine, rents, you know, you get into certain areas where just rent comparables, you have to get further and further away from the subject, and the quality kind of diminishes. So, again, it's like anything, no silver bullet. You know, the report, just because the report says, you know, we think it'll rent for $950 doesn't mean you shouldn't be looking at the detail of the report to say, yeah, but these comps are, you know, 2 miles away, 3 miles away. And so it's we wanted to arm people with the best available information, but be transparent enough that they can, you know, use their own head and supplement where needed.
Absolutely. Good stuff. So the website is just rentfacts.com, right?
It's actually www.rentfaxpro.com.
Oh, yes. You got the pro in there. Good. Good stuff. Well, Shane, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this data and sharing some good tips and advice with our investors.
You made it easy for me, Jason. I appreciate it.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.